Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. 2-for-1, no concern for the future. Living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow. Mad cow line dance song.
Hey, Sunshine Nation, welcome to the show here on another Friday afternoon. Some show notes for you. If you're looking for some pro wrestling tonight, you have WCWO, like always, at the Outlaw Arena in Indianapolis, Indiana. WPW in Jeffersonville, Indiana. Tomorrow night, you have VCW in Gadsden, Alabama. Supreme Wrestling in Madison, Indiana. RWC in Lumberton, North Carolina. AIWF Mid-Atlantic in Mount Airy, North Carolina. Shockwave Wrestling in Bern, North Carolina. Dive Wrestling in Roy, Utah. WBW in Hollywood, Florida. And NSPW in Hanceville, Alabama tomorrow. So if there's a show near you, go check it out. Support your local independents. Without any further ado, I want to welcome on our guest today. He comes to us from the great state of California. Othello, how are you doing? And thank you for joining us.
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Well, since it is your first appearance with us, we'll start you off with the first-timer's question. What led to you getting into the business of professional wrestling?
Oh, you know what? Honestly, it's something that kind of like, you know, something that kind of like fell into my lap. You know what I mean? I've always been a wrestling fan since I was like 3 years old. You know, so I mean, I was a wrestling fan pretty much all my life. But you know, how do you get into professional wrestling? So you know, basketball became primarily my thing growing up. And then, you know, one time I think it was 1998, I went to a show at the Alehead Pond at the time, and I met up with a friend of mine who was actually, you know, trained to become a professional wrestler. So, you know, I went down to the school, Ultimate University, UPW. You know, saw one of the workouts, saw how they practice and things like that, and I was hooked. That was a wrap. And I think like 4 or 5 months later, I signed up and I got into wrestling school at the age of 18.
Now, you are a rather large individual. When you got into the professional wrestling industry to start, did you come across a lot of guys that had similar size to you, or did you notice that the independents had mostly smaller guys when you were breaking in?
Well, when I broke in, the guys were big. But me, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't big. I was just coming off of basketball. I was like about maybe like 210 pounds. So, you know, when I came in, I actually came in as the world's tallest cruiserweight. But at the time when I came in, you know, I came in at the tail end of 99. So, you know, the guys, they were huge. They were very big. I mean, it was like, you know, no less than about 240.
I was the world's tallest cruiserweight. When you broke in 99, cruiserweight wrestling was red hot. You had a lot of guys trying to emulate that style. Did you do a lot of the traditional cruiserweight style wrestling with a lot of the aerial moves and the acrobatic stuff, or did you have a more unique style than that?
No, I did. I did the acrobatic stuff. That's the only reason why, you know, I was even able to get in as a cruiserweight because, you know, like I say, you know, when I was training the guys, they were huge, and you know, UPW, you know, they went by the rules. Listen, if you don't look like a professional wrestler, we can't put you out there in front of people. We can't put you out there in front of a camera and expect a guy like 285 to, you know, to sell for you and put you over. You know what I mean? You know, and so, you know, Rick Bashman, you know, he saw how hard I was working and training and stuff like that. And how I, you know, I didn't give up. I didn't quit. And so they found a spot for me. And since I was able to do, you know, moonsaults and flips and I was real aerial, they said, listen, let's just, you know, it hasn't been done before. Let's just put him in as the world's tallest cruiserweight. And as he starts to fill out and put on weight, then we'll just move him up to heavyweight. But, you know, mainly me being a cruiserweight was basically to just get me in there to get some experience. Because, you know, I went as far as I could as far as, like, training. Now it's time for me to start performing in front of people. And so I think they put me there just to give me experience and get me ready. So as I start to fill out and put on more weight, they can just move me up. So.
Now, of course, here in the recent years of your career, like you said, you have put on more weight. You are fairly big compared to a lot of independent wrestlers. Who would you say in your career has been the smallest opponent that you've ever had?
The smallest opponent that I've ever had?
Yes.
I'll have to say a wrestler named Rudy Rogers. He was about what? About 5'8 or something like that, 5'8, 5'7.
Now, you had a bit of a feud with him, as I recall it,
yeah.
And it culminated in a steel cage match, as a matter of fact. When you go into a cage match with someone that has a lot less size than you, what is the game plan in a match like that? Do you treat it as more of a normal match, or do you have a specific strategy to take advantage of the size and the fact that there's a cage there?
Oh, yeah, easy. I just take advantage of my size. You know, I'm real powerful and big. You know, I mean, there's really not much you can do, you know, do with that. So why not take advantage of my size and, you know, move my weight around, you know, and dominate the cage? So that's what I did.
Now, a lot of wrestlers enjoy going into matches that have stipulations on them, whether it's a steel cage or a false count anywhere or like a barbed wire rope match, any type of stipulation. A lot of wrestlers dislike doing those types of matches and would rather just have your standard professional wrestling rules in place. Where do you stand on wrestling in a stipulation matches? Is it something that you either enjoy or tolerate or dislike?
You know, I mean, it really depends on where the storyline is going. You know what I'm saying? Well, for me, you know, if it makes sense, you know, then why not do it? But, I mean, it's not something that I'm willing to do all the time, no. You know, because like I say, you know, if you do that kind of stuff all the time, your longevity in this business is going to be very short. You're going to have a really short shelf life. You know, so the whole key is to work smart. You know what I mean? Hard and smart. So you kind of got to pick and choose your battles with that kind of stuff. You know, to me, like matches like that, you know, it has to be built up. They have to be built up to. You just can't just throw them out there. Just to throw them out there.
One of the things that has been very popular in wrestling the last several years has been the deathmatch wrestling. You see tournaments of nothing but death matches popping up on independents all over the country. There's a niche audience for that type of match. You have wrestlers that specialize in those type of matches. I know it's not something that you would necessarily want to do on a long-term basis, but do you have an opinion on that style of wrestling? And do you see yourself doing the occasional death match?
No, I would never. I ain't gonna say never. I mean, it really depends on if it makes sense or not. But as far as how I feel about it, I mean, you know, it's cool. I mean, everybody got their preference on how they want to do things. You know what I mean? Me personally, it's not something that I would do all the time, but I don't knock any wrestler that decides to go that route because I mean, it is a genre for that. You know, you do got a fan base, you know, that enjoy death matches. So on my end, I don't really have anything much, or I don't have a problem with death matches. For me, it would just have to, for me to do it, it would just have to make sense for me to do it. That's all.
Completely understand that. A lot of wrestlers in their careers will wrestle at a particular venue that becomes their favorite place to wrestle, whether it's the aesthetics or just the ease of getting in and out of the building or the atmosphere with the fans, whatever reason it might be for them personally. Do you have a favorite venue where you wrestle?
Well, my favorite venue was when I was with Championship Wrestler from Hollywood, and we used to tape by the Glendale Studios. That was my favorite venue.
Championship Wrestling from Hollywood, prior to the pandemic hitting, was getting a lot of momentum, great television coming out of there. A lot of great talent was seeking out for them. What do you think of the progression of Championship Wrestling from Hollywood?
Well, I think the progression is good. You know, I mean, they've come a long way since I've been there. You know what I mean? You know, so I just think that it's great that, you know, wrestlers from SoCal, you know, have an opportunity to go down there and just learn how TV works. You know what I mean? You know, a lot of us just work the independent scene, but then, you know, say if we get, you know, called up to like a WWE tryout or something like that, you know, it's a lot different because it's TV involved. So now you have time limits and you have things like that that you got to follow. You know, so Championship Wrestling, they get you ready for a lot of that stuff. That's why a lot of guys that came from there, that's went to, you know, WWE, that's went to AEW, Impact, you know, they succeeded, you know, because they kind of get you ready for that next level. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Now, a lot of times on television, the matches are going to be a little bit shorter just because of the time frame that you have to fit everything into the length of the program. But on just your standard house shows, you usually see matches go a little bit longer. I know you've been out there and you've had matches that have gone for quite a while, but what would you say has been the longest match?
The longest match? Let's see. I would probably have to say my match with James Morgan in Championship Wrestling from Hollywood. Yeah, we had a cage match, so, you know, it was a bring, you know, the fans brought weapons and stuff like that, so we went pretty long. And that was, you know, that was a televised match, so we had to go pretty long because it was a cage match. So, you know, that was pretty cool.
Now, when you get into a longer match and you're going 25 to 45 minutes, and especially when it's in a match like a cage match where you don't have the opportunity to go to the floor and rest a little bit and break things up like that, what type of cardio preparation do you have to do in order to make sure you make it through a match like that?
You know, a lot of ring work, you know, a lot of drills in the ring to blow you up, to get your lungs working. You know, I did a lot of running on the treadmill. You know, I did a lot of running around my neighborhood, a lot of wind sprints, a lot of running hills, you know, a lot of calisthenics. You know, it's a lot, you know, people don't understand, you know, about wrestling is when you're doing it at a high level, when you're on, you know, TV, national TV, and you're doing it at a high level, you like your condition have to be really up there, because if it's not, you know, you get tired out there, you start to be sluggy, you start to be lazy, and then that's when you risk injury. And that's how a lot of guys get hurt, you know, because they're blown up in the ring and they're not doing everything at full strength.
Now, one of the goals that a lot of wrestlers have had in the last 30 years or so is getting recognized by the Pro Wrestling Illustrated 500. It's the annual issue that wrestlers have on their calendars every year. They send in the applications. They wait with bated breath to see if they ranked, and if they did get ranked, do they move up or down the following year? Is the PWI 500 something that you personally have set as a goal, and do you kind of follow who's making it year to year?
No, I don't, because, you know, me on a personal level, I just love being in the ring. I never really, you know, wrestled to, you know, to be ranked or anything. I don't even rank myself, man. I just enjoy being in the ring. You know, I let the naysayers, I let the fans, you know, I let them worry about their stuff. I kind of just stay away from that stuff. You know, because I respect everybody that gets into that ring, that have the heart to get into that ring and take the punishment that comes with it. You know, I have respect for those guys, you know. So I don't get caught up in all that, man. I just try to get better every day. You know, I just try to get better every day, just focus on just trying to learn new things in the ring.
One of the things that has sort of died off a little bit in wrestling over the last 15 to 20 years is the role of manager. We still see a lot of them on the independent level, but there's not very many at the national level, although there's a few more than there were, say, 5 to 10 years ago.
Right.
Just in your own career, do you think that managers still have a place in wrestling, or do you think wrestling sort of evolved past the need for having managers?
I think that there's still a need for managers because there's just certain guys that are breaking in that are new. And, you know, they need that mouthpiece, you know what I'm saying, to promote them. You see what I'm saying? Until they get comfortable enough to where they're able to talk on the mic in front of the camera. You know, sometimes you need that, you know, and managers are a lot more helpful than people would think. You know what I mean? Like, I know when I was in Championship Wrestling from Hollywood, my manager was Stu Stone, and he was great on the mic, and I learned a lot from him. You know, I learned how to talk on the mic. I learned how to get comfortable in front of the camera, and he also helped me with that, you know, because that's something that he's been doing. Because what's going to sell you as a wrestler is facial expressions, the way you say things in front of the camera, your intensity. It's things like that, you know, and managers, a lot of managers, they specialize in it. And so I think that it's a place for them, but I also think that, you know, in some cases the business has kind of moved past that, but I wish that the business would get back to that, because that's when wrestling was really good, is when you had a few managers, you know, promoting their talent. You know, like wrestling was good when you had the Bobby Heenans, the Jimmy Harts, the Mr. Fugees, you know, the Sensational Sherrys. You know, wrestling was good around that time, so I think that it's something that we kind of need to get back to.
One of the other often overlooked and underappreciated jobs in wrestling is a referee. I know there's a lot of really good ones out there, and on the independents you run into some that aren't quite as good. But from your experiences, who are some of the better referees out there that promoters should be more aware that they can hire for their own shows?
You know, it sounds kind of crazy, but, you know, I don't really know a lot of them by name, because when I got to the venue, I was always had that tunnel vision. But I say a lot of wrestlers with Championship from Hollywood, a lot of the refs over there, they're definitely ready. They definitely get you ready. The independent scene, it was always somebody different. Like, when I did the independents, like, I never really consistently worked with one referee. It was always, you know, a different guy. And it was, you know, most of the time he was new. But I say Championship Wrestling from Hollywood, they got a lot of referees that are ready, because that's, you know, like I said, they specialize in that. They get guys ready.
When you're working with a younger referee and someone like yourself that has over 20 years experience, do you find it harder to have the match with an inexperienced referee, or do you see that it's easier because of your experience to kind of lead the referee to what they need to do?
Um, I mean, it really depends on, you know, how long the individual has been wrestling, but most of the time for me, it's been pretty easy. I always simplify my matches, you know what I mean, and I'm always communicating with the ref because it's a learning process when you're on the independent scene. It's a learning process, so, you know, things aren't always on go as planned, like the way you want them. But usually I communicate with the referee. I let him know, you know, what we're doing beforehand, and if he needs to do anything special, I definitely let him know that. But most of the time it's simple. You know, I just tell the ref, you know, if anything, to just shoot on me. You know, if I'm doing something illegal, you get in my face and you tell me, you know, hey, listen, we're not doing that here. I mean, you're the referee, you're the authority. No, you can't let me just walk all over you and bury you. You know, you got to have some kind of authority in it. That's why you're in the ring. So that's kind of what I tell the new refs. You know, just treat it like you would any position that you had a power of authority and then somebody wasn't listening to you. You know, you got to make sure that we go by the rules. So.
Absolutely. I agree with you on that. Now, one of the other jobs that is not appreciated by the fans so much, but everyone in the wrestling industry knows it's one of the harder jobs, and that is the job of the booker. A lot of people in wrestling will at least attempt to do that job at some point, whether it's
right
while they're actively wrestling or after they step out of the ring, they'll try their hand at it to stay connected to the business.
Yeah.
Booking something that you've ever considered doing yourself?
Yeah, eventually that's the road I want to go down. But, you know, but first, you know, I want to work for a promotion and learn the ins and outs of the business before I just jump in there and just say, okay, well, I'm gonna start running my own promotion because it's a lot of work that goes into that. I mean, if you want to be successful, it's a lot of work that goes into that. It's a really hard job because, number one, you have to have a vision. You have to have an identity. You just can't just have an event out of nowhere and don't know where it's going and don't know where you're going with it. Because if you don't know where you're going with it, if you don't have a vision, if you don't have an identity, the fans will never catch on to it. I mean, they'll probably come see their favorite wrestler, but that's all that you ever get. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. One of the things that has become very, very important to a lot of independent wrestlers in the last year since live events have been cut dramatically back or non-existent for a lot of wrestlers is merchandising. A lot of wrestlers still able to sell their merchandise online or however they've discovered to sell it, even if they aren't going to the local arena every week to sell to the fans. Is merchandising a big factor for you, or do you not delve into it as much?
No, I don't really get into it that much. You know, I mean, it was something that, you know, that I should have paid a little bit more attention to, but at the time, like I said, I had tunnel vision. I was too focused on, you know, trying to go out there and have a good match and just trying to get better. You know, I'm just, you know, I only call it, maybe I'm just too humble, but, you know, I just feel like I don't know if I'm really at that level to where I could really be promoting my merchandise and stuff. You know what I mean? I just want to just get better and just learn. That was just my main thing, is getting better, learning, and just enjoying being in the ring. You know, I kind of just stay away from all the other stuff. I'm just weird like that.
You know,
go ahead. Sorry about that.
A lot of people don't necessarily get into the merchandising end, so no shame in it.
Well, you know, really, too, it depends on the – I don't mean to cut you off, but it depends on the kind of fan base you have. If you know that you have a big enough fan base and you know that your stuff is going to sell, then, I mean, I think that is, you know, something that you should do. But if you're just breaking into the business and you're still trying to learn the ins and outs of the business and you don't have a very large fan base, you know, grow your brand first. Get out there and get noticed first. And then you can start worrying about merchandising. because a lot of people, they bring a lot of T-shirts to the shows and stuff, and they don't really sell anything. So it's like you spend all that money on getting all of that stuff printed out, but now you don't have enough money coming in. You see what I'm saying?
So absolutely, just kind of got yeah. A lot of wrestlers have a problem doing that when they show up first time ever to wrestle and they have a couple dozen different merchandise options. It's going to be hard to sell to the people that don't know who they are.
Exactly, and you know, when you go out there, you really got to look at the crowd and see, you know, see how they react to you and things like that. Oh, so it's a lot of factors that plays into being able to sell merchandise. You really got to really know where you are in the rankings. You know what I mean?
Well, at this point in time, my co-host QT Vokes is standing by, and I know that he also has some questions, so I'm going to pass things over to him.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Sun Guy. Hello, Mr. Othello. Welcome to the Turnbuckle Turmoil Show.
How you doing? Thank you for having me.
I'm surprised this is your first time on.
Yeah, it's my first time on. I've really done a lot of interviews.
Wow, okay. Well, I think right now we're at about 1,400 in our career. 1,400.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Well, Mr. Othello, I saw your YouTube video entitled Othello versus the Human Tornado. Had you wrestled the Human Tornado before?
No, that was my first time in the ring with him. That was my first time working him.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Well, now, Othello, on the Weather Channel, the meteorologists have a grading system for different strengths of a tornado. Were you concerned that the wrestling commissioner gave the Human Tornado an EF5 status on the Stafford-Simpson scale for his ultimate destructive powers?
Am I surprised?
Yes.
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah, were you aware that he may have been graded EF5 on the destructive scale before your match? That's what I'm asking.
No, I wasn't aware of that.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Mr. Othello, when you entered the ring, you stepped over the top rope in the same manner as Big John Studd and Andre the Giant.
Yeah.
When the Human Tornado entered the ring, he stepped over the middle rope. My question is, have you ever been in the ring with any wrestlers that have stepped over the bottom rope?
That stepped over the bottom rope? No, I haven't been in a ring with any wrestlers that stepped over the bottom rope, no.
Oh, okay. Well, now, speaking of which, and I don't want to categorize or put anyone in a box, but a midget wrestler, if you have ever seen the midget wrestlers, may have been stepping over the bottom rope. I think there was Cowboy Lane that may have done that, and Little Beaver, who was once body smashed by King Kong Bundy. My question is, are you a big fan of midget wrestling?
Yeah, when I did Lucha shows, they had a few of them on the show, and they did some amazing things, and I'm a fan of it. Like I said, there's a genre for every type of wrestling. So, and midget wrestling's been around for years, and I've always enjoyed it, especially when I was a kid.
Yeah, I think they had some midget wrestlers on the show Jackass back in the mid to late 90s.
Yeah.
Jackass. Okay. Were you a big fan of Steve-O, and do you believe Steve-O could have been a good wrestler?
Am I a big fan of Steve-O's cool. I've actually met him a few times. I mean, he's always been pretty cool. Do I think he would have been a great wrestler? I think he would have been able to take a good ass with me if you see some of the stuff that he did on his show. Are we allowed to cuss on here? Because I don't want to be disrespectful.
It's a rated PG-13 show mostly, but go ahead.
Okay. But he could take a beating because he got a high threshold for pain. But, you know, that's something I don't know. I mean, if you would have got trained and did all the other and did all the things necessary, no telling. You probably could have. That's something that we'll never know.
I think Steve-O could have done kind of well against the Human Tornado. I think he could have held his own.
Yeah. I mean, he did some stuff on Monday Night Raw, so.
That's true. Okay. All right. Well, Mr. Othello, from the 3 minute and 36 second mark of the video to the 3 minute and 44 second mark of the video, the Human Tornado did some dance steps in front of you in the ring. It was almost like he was challenging you to a dance off. My question is, were you a big fan of a seminal moment in the animated show South Park when Father Randy Marsh taught his son Stan Marsh how to dance to the country song Achy Breaky Heart so he could dance battle in the street against the local dance battle crew?
Was I a fan of it?
Yes.
I thought it was pretty funny.
Oh, okay. Well, it's just that the Human Tornado reminded me of Stan Marsh on South Park. That was my thing. Oh, okay. All right. Well, Mr. Othello, in a slightly more serious thing, the referee did not check for foreign objects before he called for the bell. Based on his actions for non-search, do you believe he would not qualify for a job as initial receiving and screening of convicts at Rikers Island, New York, or San Quentin, California?
Who, the ref?
Yes.
I mean, he's a new ref, you know what I mean? So that was just one mistake. I'm pretty sure at this point he probably fixed that mistake. He's probably not doing that again.
Okay. All right. But you know how it is on the internet today. Prospective employers go through people's internet or YouTube videos, and they could disqualify you for a job based on what they see on a video. And I don't think this referee could get a job at Rikers Island or San Quentin for screening prisoners as they come in if they watched your video. That's what I'm getting at.
Oh, no, yeah. Well, if they saw that, yeah, you know, you can't have prisoners coming in with weapons, so yeah.
Okay, yes. A shank, yes, or something like that. Okay.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Some kind of metal object that they could turn into a shank.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll tell you, these prisoners now, man, they can make weapons out of anything.
Oh, yeah, a lot of them have a lot of time on their hands. A lot of time. Yes. Okay. All right. Well, Mr. Othello, the bell rang for the match at precisely the four-minute mark. Now, for the first half of the 20th century, many track athletes were chasing the four-minute mile barrier, the four laps in 60 seconds each. Many track and field experts believe that had it not been for World War II, the four-minute mile would have been broken before 1950. As it was, Roger Bannister was the first Englishman and indeed the first person ever to break the four-minute mile when he ran a 3:59.4 mile. Have you yourself seen one of the iconic photographs in sports history of Roger Bannister crossing the finish line as he broke 4 minutes?
No, I haven't seen that video.
Oh, okay. Well, it's actually a photograph, and it ranks up there with Muhammad Ali when he boxed. Oh, who was that boxer in 1963 or 64? Anyway, it's one of the most iconic photographs in sports history, and I'm assigning you the homework assignment to look up this photograph of Roger Bannister.
Okay.
Okay. It's just that The bell rang for your match at precisely the 4-minute mark. Yes. Well, you got that homework assignment. Very good. Mr. Othello, the human tornado, was mostly outside the ring and trying to put off the first contact with you, or perhaps he was waiting for the right moment to launch a tornadic sneak attack when you least expected it. You tried to get at him at the 5-minute and 6-second mark to the 5:09 mark, and in the process, you had the referee pinned in the corner, and he was bent over backwards in an S shape. Did you find out if he sought out an acupuncturist after the match? Because you bent his upper lumbar area in a C shape. Did he seek out an acupuncturist?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
All I know is I won the match. That's the only thing that mattered to me.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, if you ever come across that referee again, can you ask him that question if he sought out an acupuncturist?
Yeah, I'll ask him that question if I run into him again.
Oh, okay. All right. Very good. Well, Mr. Othello, in my video analysis, the human tornado reminded me of a wrestler formerly known as Sugar Dunkerton and is now known as Pineapple Pete. Are you familiar with this wrestler known as Pineapple Pete?
Yeah, I'm familiar with him. I know he was doing some stuff with AEW for a little bit.
Oh, okay. All right. If you had a choice to travel back in time, would Pineapple Pete be one of the choices you would make if offered a tag team partner? Would he be in one of the top three?
Well, as far as a tag team partner?
Yes, if you could time travel.
I mean, yeah, why not?
Okay,
you know, if I could time travel, why not? I mean, you never know the chemistry. You know, if it makes sense, you got good chemistry, why not?
Okay. All right. Well, Mr. Othello, did you play sports in high school? And if so, did you go out for the high jump?
No, I didn't go out for the high jump, but, you know, I played basketball.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you play all 3 years or 4 years of basketball in high school?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. As a freshman, did you start out as a power forward?
No, as a freshman, I was short. I had a late growth spur. As a freshman, I played point guard in high school.
Okay, all right, point guard. One of your inspirations, Steve Nash, a very good passer.
Uh-huh.
Steve Nash. Oh, okay. Can you tell our Turnbuckle Turmoil listeners how many assists you had per game as a freshman? Assists?
You know, it varied, man. It was probably between, what, maybe 5 to 8 assists? Something like
okay.
that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now, did you get a mini growth spurt between your freshman and sophomore year?
No, my freshman year, I was about 5'9". And then my sophomore year, I was like maybe 5'10", 5'11". And then that summer after my sophomore year of high school, that summer I went from like 5'10", 5'11". I came back my junior year at 6'7".
Holy smokes. Wow. When you first entered the halls of your high school, your junior year, did people do a double take?
Yep. They freaked out because it's like 1 minute you're looking down at this kid and next thing you know, you're looking up at him, you know.
Wow. Okay.
So yeah, they definitely did a double take, you know. The only reason they knew it was me because of my face. I still had the baby face.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Gee, that kind of reminds me of the story of the great distance runner, Steve Prefontaine, back in the 70s. During his sophomore year in track and field, he failed to make the state finals in the 2-mile run, And the coach took him aside and said, I see your potential, even though you didn't make state. If you hit running very hard over the summer, I think you could turn some heads. And indeed, Steve Prefontaine did, and he won state in cross country his junior year, and then he set a national record that spring of his junior year in the 2 mile run, and the rest is history. Yes. What that has to do with wrestling, I don't know. Yes. Okay. Well, Mr. Othello, as LeBron James climbs up the ladder toward the number two ranked all points scored in the NBA, the player Karl Malone, and indeed last night LeBron went over the 35,000 point barrier, you start to hear the term GOAT or greatest of all time. Now, in NBA history, I have seen Wilt Chamberlain ranked as low as number six, the best player of all time. This is despite the fact that Wilt Chamberlain scored 100 points in a game once, and in a time when a player makes headline for scoring 50 points in a game, Wilt Chamberlain scored 50 points for an entire season, and he once had 27 rebounds in a game against one of the greatest defensive players of all time, Boston Celtics' Bill Russell. And they never took down Wilt's blocked shot statistics as they do today's player. He once had 18 blocked shots in a game. My question is, if you could time travel, who would you rather challenge in a basketball game? Wilt Chamberlain or NWO member Kevin Nash, who played basketball in college?
I'm going to go after Wilt Chamberlain because, you know, I like going after the bigger guys.
So I
would go after Wilt Chamberlain.
Well, Wilt indeed was a legitimate seven-footer, and he probably topped out at 7'1". Kevin Nash, though, he's 6'10".
Yeah, Kevin Nash is about, he's about 6'10". I think 6'11", somewhere around there.
If you could travel back in time, do you believe you could survive and be accepted into the NWO, New World Order?
Yeah, most definitely.
All right. Who would you rather have wrestled, Kevin Nash or Hulk Hogan?
Hulk Hogan, of course. Come on, that Hogan's an icon. Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm a Kevin Nash fan too, but, you know, if you got a chance to wrestle, you know, Hulk Hogan, you know, around that time, you know, when NWO was hot. I mean, come on, you know, can you imagine the kind of payday you're going to get?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you got a point there. Okay. All right. Okay, given this choice, who would you have rather wrestled, Hulk Hogan or King Kong Bundy?
Hulk Hogan, because of the payday. I mean, the payday, man. You know, it's always going to be Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan at his heights. Oh, yeah, it's always going to be Hulk Hogan, man, because, I mean, the exposure, you know, the amount of money that you'd be able to make just promoting that match. Yeah, Hulk Hogan.
Okay. I asked you about King Kong Bundy because he was on the show Married with Children twice.
Yeah, I remember that episode,
Oh, okay. Well, Mr. Othello, you can often tell a lot about a wrestler if you know his top four favorite comedies of all time. Can you tell our Turnbuckle Turmoil listeners your top four comedies of all time, your favorite comedic movie?
Oh, movies?
Yes.
Oh, well, we're gonna start off with all three Fridays. That's three right there. Hangover and
okay.
Yeah, this is a hard one right here. Hangover.
How about Airplane?
Nuh-uh.
Okay. How about Caddyshack?
And I. I mean, Caddyshack was cool, but no, I say Cheech and Chong.
Oh,
yeah, my fifth one.
Ah, yes, where they're riding down the road in that car, and Chong passes Cheech a spliff, and it was and it was actually dog shit. Yes. Okay. Okay, Fridays. Fridays was a good comedy. That had Zeus in it, our tiny listener. Were you shocked at the death of a great wrestler, tiny listener?
Was I shocked at the death?
Yes.
Yeah, I was shocked. I remember I met him before when I was small. This is the time that No Holds Barred came out. And I was at the Boys and Girls Club in Venice, and he came down there, you know, to see the kids and everything. And I remember looking up at him. Yeah, I remember looking up at him, and I remember he picked me up, put me over his head, and was like, "What's going on, little guy?" And I was such in awe because I never saw somebody that big before. You know, I mean, he went about what, 6'6", 6'7", and at that time he was about 300 pounds. So yeah, I was in awe. Yeah. You know, because, you know, because I was a big wrestling fan. So, you know, seeing him on the movie commercials and stuff and actually seeing him in real life, it was pretty cool. You know, that inspired me a lot, too.
Wow. Did he talk to you about Craig and Smokey?
No, because they weren't around yet. This was like 89. This is the time that No Holds Barred came out. So, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So this is around the time when he was just getting known. This is like his first big movie.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Boy, I wouldn't want to have been Smokey around him. I would have had to hide my gold chain. Yes. All right. Well, Mr. Othello, it's been great talking with you. At this time, I'm going to turn it back over to Sign Guy, and I hope you look up a photograph of Roger Bannister breaking the tape of the 4-minute mile. Yes.
Oh, no, I'll definitely look it up.
Okay. Back to you, Sun Guy.
Thank you, QT. Well, Othello, in your neck of the woods in Southern California, there was a long storied history of pro wrestling going back to the earliest days of the sport. You had a lot of great, great legends go through Los Angeles back when it was a territory. Guys like Freddie Blassie, Lou Thesz, Baron Sekula.
Superstar Billy Graham.
There are so many legends that made their base in that area. Do you do a lot of study of the history of that area of the country for pro wrestling?
I did. I did a little bit.
Now, did you ever come across anything when you were looking up the history of Los Angeles that may have surprised you because you had no idea about it at the time?
No, not really, because I always known that wrestling is like, you know, wrestling's always been a part of Los Angeles and California. You know, like I know they used to always do a lot of stuff at the Grand Olympic, you know, at the sports arena, you know, and things like that, so... I always knew that, you know, wrestling has always been big in Los Angeles. But I know it was mostly known for like the Lucha Libre. They used to do a lot of that at the Grand Olympic. Like I have friends that would go. I never went, but they would go. They would always tell me, you know, about the shows and stuff like that.
Lucha Libre, like you said, it was always big in Southern California and in Texas and Arizona, a lot of the border states. But it wasn't really until WCW started bringing in a lot of Lucha Libre style competitors in the mid-90s that a lot of American fans were exposed to it. Now Lucha Libre is something that pretty much all the wrestling fans recognize and they understand the rules and the intricacies of Lucha Libre. A lot of states that you wouldn't think of have Lucha Libre-based promotions in them. Even up here in the Pacific Northwest, we have a few Lucha Libre-specific organizations. What do you think it is about Lucha Libre that has captured the imagination of the mainstream American fans over the last 25 years?
I mean, number one, they're great athletes. And two, it's a fun family environment. You know, they involve the fans in everything they do. You know, and they have a lot of showmanship. You know, it's a fun environment to be around. It's a fun family environment. You know, it's great to bring your kids to bring your mom, your grandmother, the whole family. You know, it's just a good time when you go to Lucha Libre shows. You know, and again, like I say, they're great athletes. I mean, some of the stuff that, you know, these luchadors can do, I mean, is crazy. You know, like I've done shows where I've been in, like, you know, 6-8-man tags, you know, and I see some of the stuff the luchadors do, you know, the stuff they do, and I get tagged in. I'm like, why are you tagging me? And I'm enjoying the show like everybody else. But I think that's a big reason why. You know, and it's something that's
one of the other aspects of pro wrestling that's become popular in the United States over the last maybe 10 years or so is the Japanese wrestling. There is always sort of a niche market for Japanese wrestling in the United States, but we never saw it really take hold like it has in the last few years. New Japan was able to run standalone shows in a lot of United States markets and do a tour before the pandemic slowed that down. You see a lot more Americans going over to Japan and learning the Japanese style and bringing that back here. What do you think it is that finally made American fans realize that Japanese wrestling was also some of the best wrestling out there?
Well, I think a large part of it is social media kind of helped that a lot, because it was able to give them a platform to kind of, you know, show some of the stuff that they're doing over there. You know, because what they're doing over there is real different from what we do in America. You know, over there, you know, it's actually treated like a real sport. You know what I'm saying? And like I say, some of the innovative stuff that you see over there, you know, is mind-blowing. And so I think that having a platform like, you know, Facebook and Instagram and things like that, and being able to stream certain things, you know, through YouTube and stuff like that, I think really helped them with exposure. Because there's always been a fan base for Japanese wrestling. But back in the day, you know, when I was coming up, the only way you could see it is through tapes. But now there's other outlets to where you can find it. So
we're down to the last few minutes of our show today, so I want to give you ample time. If there's anything that you would like to say to the listeners, plug and promote anything and everything that you have, social medias, upcoming appearances, anything at all, floor is all yours.
All right, well, I'd like to tell everybody, if you're in Orange County, February 27th, to go check out the OCCW Heartbreak City Rumble. You know, that's the Battle Royal, and it's like the Royal Rumble. Whoever wins that Battle Royal gets a shot at the world champion. You know, I'm no longer world champion due to health reasons. But if you're in the area of Orange County, go check that show out. It's going to be a good show. You know, other than that, I don't really have anything to promote, man. You know, we had a conversation before. I haven't really been doing too well with my health. So basically, I'm just been trying to get healthy. You know, just taking it day by day, just trying to get healthy. Because, you know, I was diagnosed with a kidney disease, so I got to do dialysis every day. So I've just basically been trying to get the hang of this whole thing and just trying to get my health back to, you know, back to normal.
Well, I definitely hope that you do get back to normal and are able to get back into the swing of things. I want to wish you best of health, and hopefully we will get to have you back on the show again at some point.
Oh, yeah, I would love to be back on the show.
Absolutely. Doors always open for you, and we hope that next week they get a big crowd there at Orange County Championship Wrestling for the Battle Royal. So fans, definitely, once Othello is healthy and back in there, you should go buy a ticket. Great competitor. Has a lot of size, a lot of agility and speed in there. I think you're going to really enjoy what he's about. So if you have the chance, definitely go get yourself a ticket to watch him. We will be back with you on Sunday afternoon. It is game show day. We're going to be playing a bit of a game show with a few well-known independent wrestling personalities. And then 1 week from this very day, we'll be back with you with independent wrestler Trent Nitro. So make plans to be with us. Get out there, support your local independent pro wrestling, and we'll talk to you soon.